Hello everyone, welcome to the Reducing Health Disparities Workshop. Okay, so I'll now begin with a brief introduction to the topic at hand. So, within the perceived application of historical constraints, health disparities in 2020 are fully operative and with urgency must be reduced. These disparities disproportionately incision, life-suspending, life-deteriorating, and life-ending gaps, which continually reproduce and expand the distance between white British populations and Black and minority ethnic populations. Thus, the Black body's relationship with health institutions, systems, and sometimes services is often negatively impacted. And this obviously negatively impacts individual and collective statuses of health. Such ideas are supported by research which indicates that Black and ethnic minority individuals are more likely to experience an early death. Reports by researchers such as Jager 2015 indicates this. Disparities often also appear where we consider access to healthcare, the quality of healthcare, and health outcomes. It is also important to consider statistics which evidence disparities. Black men are twice as likely to get prostate cancer, and studies by researchers such as Jones and Chikwundu 2014 indicates that clinical and cultural factors influence these disparities. Black women are five times as likely to die in labour, and Black Caribbean people are more likely to experience severe mental health problems. The disproportionate sectioning of Black males under the Mental Health Act is often associated with mis and overdiagnosis. Black dementia sufferers are more likely to be prescribed psychotropic medication for longer periods of time. Pre-existing health disparities have been exposed by the recent COVID-19 pandemic, which has disproportionately exposed Black and minority ethnic bodies to disease and death, as has been reviewed in a recent Public Health England report. These disparities are now to be technologically exploited and manifest with the development of contact tracing apps, as also noted by research by the Health Foundation. Thus, the Stronger Together mantra has been undermined by divisions, which has seen the BAME population play the role of frontiers, acting as a protective, yet insufficiently protected barrier. Reducing health disparities supports, enhances and extends Black life. The aforementioned health disparities and issues underlines the exigent need for real systemic change and the need to improve and develop health policies and legislation which protects Black populations whilst also valuing the role of the community. It is important to examine what kind of collective duty can be assigned and how disparities must be addressed through legislation. We have two guest speakers who will be joining us this morning, and both of these speakers address health disparities in their research and in their work with the community. So just to introduce you, to give you a brief overview on both our speakers, we have Faye Bruce and Dawn Edge, who will be joining us today. So Faye Bruce is a senior lecturer at Manchester Metropolitan University in the Faculty of Health, Psychology and Social Care. She is also the chair of the Caribbean and African Health Network for Greater Manchester, an organisation established with a vision to transform the way that Caribbean the Caribbean and African community access appropriate health information and also shape healthcare systems as a result. Faye has over 6 years of experience in studying and working around reducing health inequalities in the Black community. A commitment that the CAHN network echoes within its ethos of working in partnership with trusts, local authorities, faith communities, and voluntary sector organizations to enable and effect change and ultimately improve outcomes for the Black community. Our second speaker, Professor Dawn Edge, is the Professor of Mental Health and Inclusivity and the Academic Lead for Equality, Diversity and Inclusion at the University of Manchester. On one hand, Dawn works across the Manchester University in various departments, leading a number of equality practices from staff and student recruitment to supplying recommendations, reports and advice to the university's highest level committees. On another hand, Dawn's work is focused on mental health issues within the psychology department, and in this role, she leads research and community projects which challenge the racial inequalities that persist in mental health provision and support. So I will now hand over to Faye, who will now discuss with us her work on health inequalities in the Black community and what Khan has been doing to address these issues. Hi Faye, are you able
to- Good morning.
Good morning, welcome to the workshop.
Good morning, thanks for having me. Now, are you able to share my slides,
yes,
Trishawn?
Yes, I am.
Great, thank you.
Are you able to see the slide?
I can, yeah.
Yeah, okay, great. So Faye, I'll hand over to you now.
Okay, thank you, Trishawna.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, I was just saying thank you for the introduction, and also just thinking about the best way to present my information about what's been going on since I started my work around health inequalities. But what I decided to do was just to give you a little bit of background about me and where it all started and why it all started. And then to just give you some of a trajectory about where we are, you know, the kind of journey that we've had to date. And just to tell you about some of the achievements that we're making, or some of the kind of progress that we're making to address health inequalities in Greater Manchester. So I deliberately called this health and the hostile environment because, you know, we are living in a hostile environment, and there is no getting away from that. And when we look at the picture of health in the UK for people of colour, and I normally talk about African and Caribbean people, then we have some real grave and stark inequalities that we are dealing with currently. Okay, so next slide, please. Okay, right. So I just want to give you a little bit of background about me. I want to just talk very briefly about the reality of health inequalities in the Black community. And then I want to talk to you just very briefly about Khan as well, the organisation that's been set up as a result of the work that's been done through the PhD. And then I just want to also just introduce you to the findings from the survey that we carried out through May and June. Okay, just want to start off with this statement, which basically says that all forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. And that's a quote from Martin Luther King, because I started on my journey. So in terms of my background, I am a nurse by profession. That's where I started. But I started this because I was brought up in a church, like most of us were from the Black community. And I was just really alarmed by the number of people, when I was very young, the number of people that were you know, getting ill and dying early. You know, these were people my mum's age, and my mum was in her like 30s when she had me. And I just wanted to know what was going on. Why are we seeing so much? You know, one person's here today, gone tomorrow. One person's had a stroke and they're disabled. You know, what was actually going on? So I decided that I wanted to do some work just to kind of look at, you know, look at that. So I decided to go into nursing because I wanted to find out a little bit more, but also to look at how I could influence and change things. So that was a long, long time ago. I was one of the first people to do the nursing degree when it first came out in the 90s. And I must say that, you know, during that time, you know, I faced a barrage of racism in terms of, you know, what is this Black woman doing a degree? You know, we'd had Project 2000, we had, you know, the traditional nurse training, but we've got a Black girl here coming to do a degree, and all they want to do is to become managers and researchers and things like that. Well, you know, so there were some barriers and things put in my way to try and stop me from making progress. But really, it was more about the work on the wards, which I was seeing, the kind of inequalities, the way that people were being treated on the wards, just some of the policies and things were just not working in the favour of people of colour. What we have is we have a range of different legal frameworks. We know that these things all exist. We've got, you know, the Human Rights Act, the Equality Act, the Health and Social Care Act, the Care Act, the Mental Capacity Act. We have all these things that are there to protect us as we go through society, but we know that for Black people, they're not working. So we have the we have rights, so we're supposed to have rights, and also some of those rights are about non-discrimination and equality. All of these are fundamental principles that we should really be getting. Our right to health is something that we all should expect as a basic right. But if you think about it, and these are the kind of things that I was seeing in, you know, on my journey, you know, through nursing before I became a lecturer in nursing, you know, high rates of diabetes, and Trishawna has mentioned a few of these already, high rates of diabetes, higher rates of hypertension and stroke. And, you know, I am not all about statistics, but in terms of, you know, 3 times more likely, 4 times more likely, you know, these are the kind of ballpark statistics that we are in terms of these health inequalities. Higher rates of admission to psychiatric hospitals with a diagnosis of psychotic illness. You know, Black people weren't deemed to have the kind of so-called depressions and anxiety. We're more likely to have the psychotic related illnesses, and I know Dawn will talk a bit more about that. Higher rates of sexually transmitted diseases. So we know, again, you know, if we think about HIV, that, you know, HIV is particularly prevalent in the African communities, and it's still not, you know, improving because of the allocation of resources that we know is not afforded to our communities. We have higher rates of cancers, and lymphoma, prostate cancer, also, you know, if we go on the list, stomach cancers, you know, you name it, Black people are more likely to have those cancers. We are less likely to get breast cancer, but more likely to die from it. So why is that? Why does that occur? Higher rates of infant mortality in the first month of birth. We know 122% of babies born to people of colour are more likely to die in that first month. Again, mentioned already, about 5 times more likely to die from in labour, from maternal related complications. And that is something that we were particularly alarmed on. It's, for me, it's the most starkest health inequality statistic that I have actually seen. And I've been around and I've been seeing these statistics for the last 2 decades that have come out from Embrace. And the sad thing is that they're actually getting worse. So we were at 3 times more likely 20 years ago. We're now at 5 times more likely. So we're not seeing an improvement there. And also, just to mention sickle cell disease, you know, we have a genetic predisposition to sickle cell disease, but actually the level of investment and the poor life experience that people have as a result of that is something that, again, you know, has not been afforded to our community in terms of priority setting. So I started some PhD work a good few years ago now, and one of the things that I, as I mentioned, I wanted to do was to look at these Black health inequalities. So I talked about Black health matters way back in 2016-17, I wanted to look at why, what are the hidden factors that are keeping our community in poor health? You know, why are we seeing an improvement of cardiovascular related health for white majority populations, but we're seeing a kind of no improvement or worse outcomes for people from our community? So I wanted to set out to do that. But what I didn't want to do was just to kind of like do, you know, quantitative studies or anything like that. I wanted to hear people. I wanted to speak and hear their voices about why they felt that that was happening. And so we did two phases of a study where we had a large group, over 120 people participating in the consultations. And then we had a smaller group, which really kind of like unpacked some of those issues that we discussed in phase one, and which came out with some really, really interesting findings about why we're really kind of still where we are in terms of health inequalities. So we know about all these things. We know about, you know, the health inequalities, the employment, the poverty, all of those. And those things will be discussed in different, you know, sessions today. But I wasn't particularly interested in that. Those are things that are known. We know about all of those things. But I what I'm finding is that when we look at the Black community and we look at, you know, some of the differences between Black and white people, then what we do know, and the evidence base does tell us, is that there is more of a difference between the races than outside. So within the races, we have more difference between us than we actually do have outside. We don't have, we're not more genetically predisposed to poor health, but more socially predisposed. So we know that, you know, if we look genetically at our kind of DNA, there is nothing that particularly predisposes us to poor health. There's nothing that predisposes us to having, you know, to dining our pregnancies. There's nothing genetic about that, but it's the social conditions that we are, that's causing these health outcomes. We have a higher burden of chronic disease that is intergenerational. So we can see these patterns of chronic disease. So, you know, often we hear people talk about, well, my mum had that, my grandma had that. And we see these issues passing on through the generations. But one of the things that we have really found out through talking to people is that thing about those chronic everyday stresses that, you know, impact on us. You know, and many people have started to talk about this actually through COVID. And, you know, why is it that, you know, Black people are more likely to have coronavirus and die from it? If we look at our own biology, if we look at the changes in the expression of our physiology, then we can see how we're more likely to end up with a lot of these conditions. So we've got this genetic expression that is different. It changes the way that we respond to disease. So I particularly take the view that, you know, history, we talk about our history, and history is not the past. And we're very, very much focusing on the fact that it's something that's in the present. And we carry this this history with us. And we can see that as we go through, as I was saying before, through those generations. This allostatic load, so I talk a lot about epigenetics, and I know it's a very contentious issue. However, there's a lot more scientific interest in this now, we see, is that, you know, epigenetics, again, that intergenerational pattern of disease, when we talk about this allostatic load, this wear and tear on our bodies, it accumulates over time. And if we're consistently exposed to chronic stress, the way that it actually responds, we respond physiologically, is going to result in a lot of what we're seeing today. So disparities in mortality, even after we've adjusted for socioeconomic status and health behaviours, we still see this rise in mortality for Black people. Our allostatic load is so much heavier than for people on average than white people. And it's because we're consistently exposed to this chronic stress. So David Williams talks about this quite a lot. And he says, even when people just walk out of, you know, in anticipation of going outside and facing people in society, you know, that even that kind of preparation, that preparedness for that causes us to have chronic stress. We don't tend to sleep as well. We talk about how, you know, blood pressure is supposed to be reduced as we sleep at nighttime. When they do studies that show, you know, black people and white people and do that 24 ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, we find that with black people, that blood pressure doesn't drop. So we don't have that resting phase, which again causes us to have higher blood pressure. So I've already mentioned it changes the physiological profile, and the load is heavier, independent of traditional socio behavioural risk factors. So again, you know, those reminder of all the different health disparities that we see, and this is some things that we've just been picking up over the course of the last few years. This was just like a little example of diabetes. We know it's particularly prevalent in our community, and we know around internal racism. And, you know, there is something about diabetes because of the environmental stresses that actually causes us to become, you know, less likely to be glucose intolerant. So these are the kind of things that we know changes our physiology because of some of those environmental stresses that we face. So in terms of my study, it's actually called Uncovering the Voices of Caribbean and African People in Their Struggle for Decoloniality in Health. So for me, it's about looking at critical race theory and looking at it in an intersectional way to examine society, culture, as they relate to categorizations of race, law, and power. And I use critical ethnography because it's about how we build more equitable health markets. Black people generally do not have access to the health market. There are health failures out there that are actually causing barriers for us to actually improve our health outcomes. So we're looking at power and how that is produced within the current system and interrogating that and looking at change. So that's the reason why I'm doing a critical ethnographic study. Okay, so out of all of that, we have the Caribbean and African Health Network. So I just remember when I was doing the consultations with the community for the first phase of the study, and the first question that was asked to me was, right, okay, well, we're all here. I had about 60 people in a room. It's fantastic. The first question was, so what are you going to do with the information now that you, when you, once you've collected it? Because people were sick and tired of actually giving information and seeing no change. For me, the first thing, and I came armed and I knew that I was particularly passionate about change in the Black community in terms of their health outcomes. Remember, I started in my nursing and seeing all these people in churches and whatever, and I wanted to do something about it. So I was passionate about change. So as a result of what we found and what I assured people I would do, I didn't realize I was going to do it so early, was within 6 months of actually collecting the data, I started CARN, and it's the Caribbean and African Health Network in Greater Manchester. And it's very, very much built on intelligence and collaboration with the community about what they wanted to see to improve their own health. So we've been, since 2017, we have been working to build on what the community has said. And this is a product of that, as we go through that journey. We are by no means, you know, met our mission, which is all about reducing health disparities within a generation. That's what we are aiming to do. So I'm not going to read out all our core objectives, but it's all about collaboration. It's all about partnerships. It's all about really influencing and impacting the systems that will determine how we actually, you know, enjoy or whether we enjoy health, whether we have a good health experience. So we know that we have structural and institutional challenges. We have decision-making and representation. We know that across the whole of the UK. You can handpick the number of people from our community that are in those decision-making positions. And we are, Carn is very, very much present in a number of those decision-making, around those decision-making tables, because we know that we can't just have people doing things to us, and that we've got to be around the table to determine what is, you know, decisions are actually being made to improve our health outcomes. So there are a lot of partnerships that we have with, for example, Greater Manchester Health and Social Care Partners, MFT, Manchester Foundation Trust, and others, where we're really making an impact to change the way that Black people receive healthcare. There is a lot of benchmarking to majority populations, and we've seen some of that. I mean, I don't even need to say, when we talk about COVID, we talk about how, you know, PPE isn't really suitable for, you know, for people of colour. You know, things have been benchmarked to the white majority population, and we've seen, you know, potentially that some of those have resulted in, sadly, some of those deaths because of the lack of appropriate PPE. We know that we have this racial discrimination and bias. In nearly every document that I've looked at, you can see where it actually sits and how we need to dismantle some of those. The community engagement is something that we really want to work on in terms of engaging our community. So we don't tend to work more in silos, but we talk with one voice. And we want to, you know, gather information, FOIs, all of that about the investment in our, to our community. We know £6 billion came into Greater Manchester under devolution. And we know that our community has hardly seen any of that money. It's just not been invested in our communities. And we need to look at how we collectively change that. We have a number of health programmes, and you can see from here, when we talk about health inequalities, how these health inequalities around diabetes and cardiovascular disease, mental health, we focus on the things that are prevalent within our community, and we lobby, we campaign, we get health education information out there. We've been doing lots of information education sessions. Every Saturday we have health hours. We go out to places and we really look at how we can educate and equip our community with the tools to enable them to manage their own health. And we will, you know, we did some Healthy Hearts just before the lockdown, and we did four events. And we did blood pressure screening, atrial fibrillation screening. We had to refer out 600 people. We referred just under 50% to GPs because of high blood pressure and atrial fibrillation, which is a rapid heart rate, and it can cause, it's one of the best detections for stroke. So we've been doing a lot of work around some of these health programs. But a lot of lobbying and holding people to account. We've got a review of sickle cell services in Greater Manchester. The issues around maternal mortality. We've had Greater Manchester Health and Social Care Partnerships. We have helped holding these people to account for change. We've got an advisory group set up now, which is looking at how do we ensure that the experience of Black women are improved, so the outcomes aren't what we're seeing today. So just very, very quickly, you know, there's been a huge impact. We've all probably seen the reports from on COVID-19 around all the health disparities. Again, you know, when this whole thing started, even before the pandemic was announced, we said, and we put out our bulletin, we said, this is going to have a disproportionate impact on the Black community. We put out warnings to people. We said, look, if you've got underlying health conditions and, you know, other things, you work in those precarious roles, etc., you need to look at how you can protect yourself. You know, so these are the things that we put out way back in early March last year when we heard about the coronavirus. And even though we, you know, some of those socioeconomics and underlying conditions, when they're not there, we know we're almost twice as likely to die from coronavirus. We've done a survey. We did a survey. We had over 334 people complete the survey. We put this out in April of this year because we wanted to see how people were responding to coronavirus. Again, trying to understand some of the health inequalities and why those things were causing us, you know, the issues that were actually taking place. To no surprise, so we asked a number of questions and we had some really stark findings, really interesting findings. 59% of respondents were concerned about the mental well-being of their children, and 43% of adults concerned about their own mental well-being. One of the things that really stuck out for us was 74% of those people said they wanted Black-led services as a result of the cultural insensitivity and the perceived systemic racism. So many comments were coming back. This is what people want. They want people that look like them to deliver services in the most culturally sensitive way, because they know about the exposure and the facts that they've had such poor health experiences in the past. So this is something that we were really highlighting. And of course, faith is such a big part of the Black people's lives. We know 84% either go to a church or have some affiliation to a church. So that loss of physical connection, which is very, very much about how we address some of the mental well-being in our community. Okay, so that's kind of the end of my talk. And it was just really to give you a picture of where we started and where we are now in terms of addressing health inequalities. And just, you know, we were on a call last night. It was put together just 2 hours after the, you know, we've heard obviously about, many of us might have heard about the unfortunate circumstances that occurred on Saturday night with the, which resulted in the, you know, killing of two of our community members. And we had a meeting last night with well over 100 people. You know, again, it always comes down to the health of people and how they experience things. You know, so it was just really, really moving just to be on that forum and to hear people's frustrations at the system that we're actually dealing with. And again, it just results in further health inequalities that we just see this widening. And even Michael Marmot, who many of you might know, who sat in our office a year ago, just over a year ago, and told us that race wasn't a factor in terms of health inequalities. What we do know is that he's actually put out his 10-year review, which came out at the back end of last year, which actually identifies race as a social determinant of health. It really is something that will impact on people's health. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Faye, and all the wonderful work that you're doing in the community. I have two questions that I'd like to ask you.
Yeah.
So when considering the clear racial disparities in your field, what do you think would be required to create legal duty in your sector to address these? And what do you think such a duty would entail or should entail?
Okay, so I did say I'm not a lawyer. And you know, to answer that is quite difficult to do that. Okay. What I do know is that we, and as I mentioned earlier on, is that we have a lot of legislation that exists at the moment. We have the Human Rights Act, we have a lot of things that are out there that I don't believe that we're actually using properly. I think all the information is there. When we talk about discrimination and you know, whether it's indirect or direct, there's a lot of legislation that's currently there that we can use better. And I think that we need to be working with, you know, the legal profession to actually look at how we can use that legislation to address some of these health inequalities, because the Health and Social Care Act, all of these things talk about, you know, proportionate universalism. It talks about all those things. But I don't think as a community of people that we're actually using that very well. So I think that is something that we definitely need to be looking at.
Yeah, that's a very valid point there, Faye. Could you tell us how COVID-19 has exacerbated health inequalities?
So according, you know, to the survey that we've done, we've got had lots of voices, lots of people saying things, but we're also seeing a lot of the media. We have a network which and also a helpline as well, where people will come to us. We're constantly getting calls from people on the front line asking what they should do about this, about that, the equality, the risk assessments. And people have, they're just very fearful. They're very fearful of the fact that they are deemed, regardless of whether the socioeconomic situation is going to affect, the fact that being Black is enough to actually bring about the health disparity. So it doesn't change any for me. It doesn't change anything. It absolutely changes nothing. It's the same issues that when we talk about 3 times more likely to have diabetes. Coronavirus is just another one. It's just another virus. It's just another thing that's going to impact our community more. It hasn't widened it. It's the same issues of racism, the discrimination that we face across all institutions. So for me, it's made no difference. All it's done is shine the spotlight on the fact that we are so, we have such poor outcomes. That's all it's done for me in terms of coronavirus. It doesn't change anything. And like I said before we knew about the pandemic, we said to people, you know, if you've got diabetes, you've got this, that, and the other, you know, you are probably going to be more affected. So it's not changed anything in answer to that, Trishauna.
Thank you for your answer. What kind of approach do you think is needed to address these inequalities that we're seeing?
We certainly do need, and I think it's fantastic what I'm seeing now. I mean, CARN is an umbrella organisation. It's an infrastructure organisation. It's about bringing people together to work in a more united way. I can't claim that I've been on the community front for a long time. I'm not going to say that. But what I did see is a lot of fragmentation, a lot of working in silos. You know, one person's doing that over there, one person's doing that, and people aren't actually talking to each other. So I think that united approach, that one voice approach, is something that we need to address that and to really hold our decision makers to account for the lack of investment that they've afforded to our communities. So I think as a community of people, we need to work together a lot more. And we need to use the capitals in our community. We've got a lot of capitals. People have got so much that they can bring to the table. And we need to look at how we can utilize them to the best of our, you know, to advantage our community. So I think that thing for me about communities coming together is really, really important. That one voice approach is the way that I feel that we are really going to start to see and rustle some feathers as well. You know, we need to shake the system a little bit. We need to frighten the system, you know, and we need to do that in a more united way. And as the people often say, you know, numbers is a game changer. The more we come together, the louder we speak, the more likely we are to be heard. And that's something that I feel we've tried to do in the past, but I think we need to do that a lot better.
Absolutely. Just another question. If you were involved in developing a new approach towards tackling the disparities, how would you involve the community? I know you've said you've done a lot of work on health programs and so forth. Would that be the main method you would use to continue to tackle the disparities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing better than empowering the community with knowledge, with the tools so that they can self-manage self-care. You know, that was the way that the community wanted to learn when we started out in 2017. You know, it was about, you know, the information that's out there isn't tailored, it's not culturally sensitive, you know, it's not religiously appropriate for many of our community to engage with that. So, you know, the approach that we've taken is by, and again, I mean, I've not touched on half the things that we're doing across Greater Manchester, but it's about how we work with our community to empower them with that education to be able to prevent some of these things in the first place. So very much a grassroots led approach to addressing health inequalities.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time, Faye. Okay. So we'll now hand over to our next speaker, and then we'll have a question and answer session following her presentation. So Dawn, are you now in the room?
I am indeed.
Hi, Dawn. Welcome to the chat.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us. So Dawn, can you tell us about your work in addressing mental health inequalities and what role legislation has played?
Oh, okay.
So legislation such as the Equality Act and the Mental Health Act, how have they reduced disparities?
Okay. So I am a professor of mental health and inclusivity at the University of Manchester, and that is a bit of a journey that I've been on that's taken me to that point. And it started in terms of academic research with my PhD, which was about depression during and after pregnancy amongst Black women. So I was really intrigued about why it is that I didn't know any Black women who talked about having postnatal depression when it was, you know, it was on EastEnders, it was in magazines, Gail Porter was talking about it, there were all these conversations in a public sphere, but not amongst Black women. And so when I began to explore that as an idea, and what really cemented that I needed to do it, was that I would talk about it to white women. And generally speaking, I think Faye said it in her presentation. She said, you know, oh, my mum had that. And lots of white women would say that. They'd go, oh, my mum had that. Or my, you know, I knew somebody. Or there was always a personal connection with depression during and after pregnancy. And when I talked to Black women, they'd go, oh, that's really interesting. Good luck with that. And there's never, ever any personal connection. And I just thought, well, you know, either it is that we don't get it, as Black women, we just don't have postnatal depression or antenatal depression, or we get it and we don't know that's what it is or where to find help or what, but something's going on, because it can't be that when we know that globally 15% of all women will develop significant depression after pregnancy, and that actually for women of colour, and a lot of this work has been done in places like Brazil, in different parts of Africa, the rates are significantly higher. So I thought, well, that it can't be that we don't get it. There must be something else going on. So that turned into my PhD study, which was to screen Black and white women for depressive symptoms, and then to talk to Black women about their experiences and about where they seek help, what kind of help they think is appropriate. And so you wouldn't be surprised to know that there's a lot of overlap with what Faye was saying, because although about a quarter of the women had symptoms that would equate to moderate depression, so the kind of depression that the GP would think about prescribing antidepressants and or talking treatments, but those women hadn't, the white women had accessed mental health support, but not the Black women generally. When I asked women about where they would get, you know, if you had a problem, where would you have someone you could talk to? And white women and Black women were equally likely to say yes. But actually only the Black women talked about going to places of worship. So even though they were not necessarily members of churches or other religious organizations, Black women would say they would seek spiritual support when they were distressed. And there were a number of other differences between the two groups, which I'm happy to talk to you about if that would be helpful. One of the other things that happened during that study was that when I talked to, so I collected my data at St Mary's Hospital, which is part of Manchester Foundation Trust now. I collected my data there, and I interviewed not just the women, but some of the staff, some of the midwives and other members of staff who were caring for women. And I would ask them about their, you know, how they go about doing that. But I also went to mother and baby units. There's one in Manchester, which was then at Withington Hospital. I went to the one in Birmingham. I went to the one in London. And at all three places, they said, we don't see Black women here. What's that about? What do you mean? So mother and baby units, if you don't know, are specialist psychiatric centres where women who've got severe postnatal depression or psychosis can go, and because they're specialised in that, they will have people who can help to care for the baby so the mum doesn't lose the bond with the baby. So I was thinking, what's that about then? So, and there were two things, because I went back later on and interviewed just staff for my postdoctoral fellowship. And what was really interesting were people were talking about essentially being colorblind. So they were seeing it as a good thing. What they were saying is, oh, we'll just treat everybody the same. It's all, you know, we're just, you know, we're not interested in people's color or what's different about them. We just want to treat everybody the same. And whilst I totally understand that, insofar as the NHS is supposed to be set up as an organization which provides equality of service and a standardized service, by doing that, you know, one size fits all approach, what it doesn't take account of course is the difference between people and the way we, you know, in this case in perinatal depression, the way we might care for our children, what we might think about the stresses that are on us all the time that Faye's already alluded to in everyday society, what we would see as being depression. So one of the things that was very clear in talking to these women is that having a feeling down, so that they never talked about depression, they never called it depression. They always called it things like feeling down or feeling flat. And what they were saying, well, that doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily an illness. This is a phase of life. Everybody goes through this. And also they talked about what happened in their families and wider communities when people did signal distress, is that what they had reinforced to them, reflected back to them, was a strong Black woman discourse, is that we don't do that kind of thing. We're strong women. And indeed, women were talking about looking back at their mothers and their grandmothers. A number of people who said, you know, I remember my gran, and she, you know, she had six kids and she did two jobs and she did all of this. And my mum, when we were growing up, she didn't even have a washing machine. She did everything by hand. And they never got depressed. So I've got it easy. So I don't have a right to feel depressed. And indeed, other members of their families telling them when women had actually gone to seek help and had been prescribed antidepressants to flush them away, because we don't do that kind of thing. So with that, and then we had, I am also a member of a Black majority church. And so I, you know, the church is predominantly women. So I was looking around there and thinking, if one in four people will develop some sort of mental health issue across their lifespan, how many people in my church of 300 odd people is that? So I did the math and I was thinking, every Sunday I'm going to church with people who have definitely got some kind of psychological distress. If not now, they're likely to develop that later on. And what are we doing? You know, given that these women had told me that if they had a problem, church is one of the places that they would go to. Even if they were not church members. And so that started, that resulted in our first ever faith and mental health conference. And that was in 2009, and we've been running them since. And the very first one, we focused on psychosis and schizophrenia and depression. And then when we asked people about what their priorities are, so what other things should we be doing research on, you wouldn't, again, be surprised to know that dementia has become one of those things. So we've had two dementia conferences. But I mentioned psychosis, and I know that Faye mentioned it in her talk as well, because whilst we are unlikely to be diagnosed, I mean, we as in Black people, both men and women, are unlikely or less likely than the majority population to be diagnosed with anxiety or depression, we are significantly more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia and psychosis. So, you know, there was a piece of work done in London, Bristol and Nottingham, and the rates there, it was shown that if you were of Caribbean origin, including people of mixed or multiple heritage, your risk of being diagnosed with schizophrenia is 9 times greater than if you're a white British person in the UK. And it's about 6 times greater if you're Black African. Okay, so I'll just leave that one for a moment. So when I started that, then that's not new. So the numbers vary depending on whose research you read, but that work has been happening. People have been writing that kind of research since the late 50s, early 60s, and more going into the 80s. And what they were finding was that actually in lots of occasions, it was getting worse. The rates were getting higher and higher. What struck me as being very interesting was the lack of any intervention. So there was no culturally relevant intervention for people from African or Caribbean communities, psychological therapy, talking treatments. And yet when we had the conferences and we asked people what kind of research should we be doing, what they said was, we need something that's actually going to change the way services are delivered. So we want less reliance on medication, because as soon as you're a Black person, first and the only thing often that you're going to be offered, and actually not offered, you're given it, you're forcibly given it, is medication by being injected, forcibly held down, and that happens. But we don't have any access to talking treatments. And there is, we know that there are issues, because I was one of those people who grew up being told that you don't talk your business. And there is quite a reluctance to talk about mental ill health. So there is that tension, because people are saying we don't want medication. To talk, but we don't have any people that we can talk to, because people in the services don't necessarily understand our story. So put it into context. So when we talk about our everyday experiences, they might then end up being labelled as signs of mental distress. So if I tell you, this is an example, we're talking to a colleague of mine as a white psychiatrist, and I was talking to her about the need for an intervention like the one that we now are developing. And I was saying, you know, because about racism being an everyday lived experience and how traumatic that is. And how exhausting it is, and how damaging that is to both our physical and mental health. And I said to her, you know, it's things like, you know, you go into a shop and people follow you around. And she went, what do you mean? Now, I don't know any Black person that I've ever said that to who has to ask me what I mean. So I said to her, well, that's the issue. I said, right there is the issue, because I've explained something to you that is a part of my everyday experience and the experience of members of my family and wider community. You are working in a system and in a part of the UK where there are disproportionate numbers of Black people in your services who you are working with every day, but you don't know this. So when a Black service user or Black somebody comes, is referred to you or is brought in under the Mental Health Act, and he or she tells you that people follow them around in the shops, do you just write that down as paranoia? Because you don't actually know that that's our everyday experience. So at which point, to give her a due, you know, she did acknowledge that she didn't know and didn't understand. But that lack of understanding is, for me, is very intriguing, because you asked about legislation. So we know that the NHS was set up, the whole ethos of the NHS was about equality. So before the NHS, people had to make a choice between, you know, ordinary people had to make a choice between being able to buy food or pay for heating or see the doctor, because they couldn't, because it wasn't free. So that was the whole point post-war, was to create a society where people didn't have to worry about their health, where the health of the whole nation could be improved by access to immunisation, to screening, to all of the things that many of us now take for granted. The problem is that the way that now plays out is that it's not equal, and it's not had the impact in reducing the inequalities on health across the board. So for Black people from infants or even pre-birth, so again, as Faye alluded to, even from the birthing experience all the way through to older people care and palliative care, all the way through our experiences are less favourable, less positive, and our care, the care is worse. Would you want me to say that? Is that
right?
No?
You can expand. Yeah, please, could you expand on how you think legislation reduces the disparities?
Well, I don't think they do.
You would agree with that it does, yeah.
I think that's the problem, is that we do have a legislative framework. As I said, you know, we have an health system that is born out of a premise of seeing health as a social justice issue, and saying, yeah, you know, equality is at the heart of the NHS. But nobody, including the people who run the NHS, seem to take that on board when it comes to the fact that so many of us have unequal health and worse and poorer health outcomes. And that's across the board, that's both in terms of ethnicity, but there's a huge north-south divide. We know that, and we keep writing about it, and people keep talking about it, but what we don't seem to have are any strategies for dealing with that. So obviously my work is predominantly in mental health. The work I'm doing now is comes out of those conferences that we've had, and so we are working now to develop culturally relevant talking treatments by working with people from Black, African and Caribbean backgrounds, including those of mixed and multiple heritage. We're working with them to actually come up with the kind of talking treatments that they would find that we would find accessible and helpful. So we're doing that. We've done some previous research and we've now got a randomised controlled trial, which is what's required before bodies like NICE would recommend uptake into the NHS. Unfortunately, the trial has had to be paused because of COVID, but I'm really hopeful that we'll be able to get started. But just going back to the point about legislation. So we've got the NHS established in 1948. You may or may not know that actually the mental health services were not part of that. So like GPs and mental health services, they were not really part of that original framework. People with mental health difficulties were still in the asylums, which were a different entity altogether. So the first Mental Health Act was in 1959, and that was supposed to improve the care, the quality of care given to people, because you can go and do your research, and there's quite a lot of stuff you can find online about what used to happen to people in those asylums, and it wasn't pretty. And as far back as 1961, there was a proposal that those asylums should close. But many of you know that it was 1990 when we had the Care in the Community Act. So for all those years, people were still being detained. Maybe up to around the 1970s, people started to, the asylums really started to close down and being turned into apartments and various other things. We first had had our first Mental Health Act in 1959, and then that was reviewed and revised in 1983, and that revision wrote into the Act more about consent and about people giving informed consent. And actually written into that is that you can only be detained. One of the key criteria for detaining people under the Mental Health Act is that they need to pose a risk to themselves or to somebody else, the risk of harm to themselves or somebody else. And that's thought to be one of the main reasons why there's such massive disparities in the way the Mental Health Act is used with Black people as opposed to other people. And it's a lot of, some of it's around that perception of harm and dangerousness, because we still have a society that we've seen with all that's been unfolding before us, where people link and associate Blackness, particularly with males, Blackness with dangerousness. And so it's easy to apply that. So we had a revision of the Mental Health Act in 2007, again, to make it more inclusive and less restrictive. And then we had the Equality Act that you mentioned. And so, there's all this legislation. And there's also things like NICE guidance. So since 2002 was the first NICE guidance around mental health. Since then, they've put out about 80 pieces of policy guidance about how services should work, and all of it designed to reduce inequalities but improve quality of care, but that's not really happened. In 2016 and 17, there was a new five-way forward review policy document that was written to improve mental health services, mental health care. So that was 2016, 2017. So we're kind of moving towards the end of that five-year period. And then in 2018, there was a review. So Theresa May talked about the rising use of the Mental Health Act to detain people with mental ill health as being a burning injustice, one of the burning injustices of our day, and the fact that that it was disproportionately used with Black people. So I was very privileged to be part of that review. A couple of the things have been taken up specifically around people's right to advocacy and to be able to get better quality of advice and information in relation to sectioning. But a lot of it, you wouldn't be surprised to know, first of all, there's Brexit and now there's COVID. So we're having to kind of push from behind to make sure that some of those 154 recommendations we made in total, for those to be enacted. So it's not that the framework doesn't exist. The framework is there. What I struggle to understand is why it's not enacted. Because we know that part of the Equality Act is that every public sector body has what's called a public sector equality duty. It's written into law, and it's about avoiding not just overt discrimination, but we know about terms like direct and indirect discrimination. So the legislation is there. It's just not enacted. And I suspect that what it will take is for a class action suit, for a smart lawyer to get on it, and then maybe things will change, because the laws, the legislation's there. We don't need any more. We just need to use what we've already got.
Yeah, thank you. So you've really emphasised the need for alternative interventions in your presentation. Do you think that traditional methods or a cultural or faith-based policy could be enshrined in legislation to address the disparities? Okay. So tradition
faith,
is in...
Faith and spirituality is one of the characteristics. It's already in legislation. Okay. But in terms of the kind of the way that is then played out in the way services is developed is a different matter altogether. Okay. So...
is there anything new that could be added to those policies, do you think?
No, I think we just need to make sure that they're enacted. That's the bottom line. And I think... what I would say is that, and Faye again mentioned this in her talk, was about that people wanting to be able to at least have the choice of having people who they feel are going to have a better understanding of their lived experience and not pathologize the way they live and see that as being part of the, you know, the illness presentation, but actually understand their everyday experience. The work that we've done, actually, people have been very nuanced about that. So on the one hand, they want that, that people are saying, we definitely need something we need interventions. In my case, talking about talking treatments, which are culturally relevant and culturally aware. But what people are saying is, but we shouldn't have to bear the burden of providing that. So if we have a national health service, which is supposed to provide care, which is equal for everybody, then the NHS itself should be equipped to deliver that care. And that means everybody. So personally, I find it inexcusable that in 2020, it is still possible for people to graduate from health and social care programs, which are funded from the public purse, without having done any work on culture, on race, on looking at so-called unconscious bias. They don't have to do any of that work, and then they go on and work with people from diverse backgrounds without any preparation. So I think those are the kind of things that we need to do, is to marry up the policies and the legislation we already have with how services are designed and delivered. And I think, and a really important part of that is the training. That's the key thing in the therapy that we deliver, if I'm honest. We've culturally adapted a form of family therapy, but when we ask service users about the components that come up, we tweak some of it. It's like, for example, putting more stuff in around spirituality and faith and so forth. But the main thing they talked about was training up therapists to be aware of the power imbalance that exists in society between clinicians and patients, between Black people and white people, between, you know, there's a whole range of different things that happen in that therapy room that's not written down. And if a therapist is unaware of that, particularly in something like psychology, where maybe 85-90% of the therapists are going to be white women, and a lot of the service users are going to be Black men, if we're not aware of what happens in that dynamic, then actually you can't do effective therapy if you can't call it out. If Black people are going into therapy and they can't talk about racism and talk about the trauma because they're worried that the therapist is going to see that as being some kind of racial slur against them, if when they do raise it, the therapist feels threatened or feels ill-equipped to deal with their responses, then that's not good therapy. So it's no wonder people don't want it. But I don't think it should be our responsibility as a community, totally. I think we definitely need more Black people and people of colour more generally in psychology and other professions, but that's only a part of the issue. Everybody should be equipped. Everybody should be equipped to be able to work in a way that's empathic, that's respectful, that's compassionate, and that gives therapists the skills and the confidence to say, do you know, I don't know that. I don't understand about that, but I will go away and find out.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation, Dawn. So we'll now go ahead and take some questions from the audience. So you can, or the audience, you can direct your questions to both Faye and Dawn.
Got a question for Faye. It was to do with the survey, and you were talking about 74% of people wanted Black-led services. I know Dawn has just sort of mentioned this thing about having sort of separate services. And when you were talking about that, it seemed to me that you could end up having a sort of a very siloed system, and we could end up with a second-rate quality of care. So I just wondered what you saw as a way to, were you thinking about these as forums for people to, where they would feel safe to go in order to access, in a sense, mainstream services, because you don't want to have a whole separate system. The NHS should be for everybody.
Okay, so yes, we're not about a two-tier system. We can't have that, you know. But what it is about is currently the mainstream system or the services do not provide culturally appropriate care. What we do find is there's a lot of mistrust within the healthcare system. What we and as a result of that, we often have things like late presentation to services, which are again resulting in some of the health inequalities that we see. So in order for us to respond to that, we do have a number of Black-led services, people that understand them, people that understand and have a lived experience. And this is what people need. People are in, many people are in crisis right now, and they need a response that is going to be urgent in order to address their problems. And if we are waiting decades for the NHS to respond, we've not just landed here. Windrush brought hundreds of people. You know, we've got, you know, a large majority of people of colour in the UK, but yet they've failed to respond to providing those culturally appropriate and sometimes religiously appropriate services that people want to engage with. So that is the position that we're in. People are fed up, they are tired, they are sick and tired of being quizzed and being treated with disrespect. But they want to go to a service that's going to look at them for who they are and provide the care that they need. So this is what we're seeing in the 74% outcry, really. We don't want a two-tier system, we don't want that, but this is our this is how people are responding. And we do have a real need to of the mainstream or provide the decision makers to invest in some of those, urgently to invest in those, so we can get on with the job that needs to be done. The VCSE sector organisations, there are lots of them that are out there at the moment trying to do good work, and it's because the gaps in the mainstream services are there, they've not provided. So the VCSE sector organisations, the Black-leds have stepped in. It's a bit like Khan at the moment. We've provided a bereavement service because we're responding to COVID. We know we've had, the mortality rates have been so much higher. But what people have been directed to is a mainstream service that is not culturally and religiously appropriate. So this is what people are saying. This is what we need to happen so people actually get the care that they absolutely deserve and need.
And what about the whole issue of, in a sense, racism, which is, professionals may not even know that you know, that their responses are racist. There are studies in terms of the way in which Black pain is but it's not recognized as much, that when Black people feel pain that it hasn't been recognized in the same way. And this could well be one of the reasons why the rates of, you know, people aren't getting the treatment for cancer and things like that soon enough. So what kind of system could be put in place? I mean, I don't know, but
these are issues. Yeah, I mean, I know as obviously somebody teaching in nursing as well, and when we know, for example, the Nursing and Midwifery Council, they have a curriculum. You know, they have, you know, these are the outcomes that you are supposed to be delivering on. So we have hundreds of students come through every year, and what I wanted to do was to be in a position where I could actually influence that curriculum by ensuring that people were actually given that education that they need. So when you're talking about pain, you know, how do people experience pain? Why is it we're still looking back in history and those perceptions of Black women not needing pain relief, because of, you know, what's actually happened in the past. So in my role, I ensure that I deliver that education to our nurses, the nurses that I have, the programs that I have control over. But I'm a Black woman. I know what the issues are, so I can present them. But most of the lecturers are white. They probably wouldn't even come to their, you know, consciousness that it's something that needs to be actually delivered. I think the curriculum needs to be changed. It really does. The medical curriculum, you know, the nursing curriculum, the health and social care curriculum needs to be more inclusive about some of these issues that we know because we have the lived experience. We need that to be, you know, embedded in the teaching. You know, sickle cell, absolute crisis at sickle cell. Medical students have 5-10 minutes of information or education around sickle cell. And yet they end up on the wards, you know, going out to work on the wards. They don't know how to treat people with sickle cell. And when we talk about pain again, they put it down to all kinds of reasons as to why, you know, people might be crying out for pain relief. As though there's some kind of junkies and things like that. You know, so we do need an education system that is more inclusive. It takes into account the experiences that Black people, you know, face, and it needs to be embedded. And so we need to hold these providers or the education institutions to account for that. It shouldn't be that 2020, we're still having to be talking about these real basic issues about, you know, what Black people are supposed to be getting as a fair, you know, an equitable system of care. So I really believe that in order to change things, we do need to have an education system that is more inclusive.
Thank you, Faye. We have a question for Dawn from Ruth. So I was involved in putting together cultural competency framework for the NHS, but when the NHS moved from Equality Delivery System 1 to EDS 2, it was dropped as it was seen as too difficult. Do you have any thoughts about how something like this could be introduced?
Yeah, and it just, it goes back to the point that was being made previously, isn't it? Is that, what do people mean by it's too difficult? Do you know who developed it? And if it's something that people can't use, if it's not a system that services can use in a meaningful way, then let's find a different system. But let's not just get rid of it altogether, because in the absence of something that holds services to account. So I used to be a non-executive director. I've been on more than one board, and I know what the challenges are in terms of delivery. So if it's not there on what is one of your key performance indicators, if it's not one of your priorities, if it's not there as part of CQC inspection, for example, and you don't have people in your organisation who really see it as a priority, it's not going to happen.
Thank you.
So it needs to be within the system. It needs to be within the framework. I think we know we've got a RES, the Workforce Race Equality Standard, and that's not really very well applied across the board. We definitely need a patient version of that. So, and services, the CQC or some other body should be judging every service against those standards and giving them, you know, their rating, whether it's a gold standard or red, green, whatever system we use. But it should be really clear to people going to those services that this service is able to deal with me as a Black person and this one isn't, for example.
So Dawn, you believe that improved clarity is required to create legal duty in your sector, is that right? Would you say that?
I think it's political will to actually do what we have the legislation for doing. It's not, we don't need new legislation. It's just about applying that. And I think, as I said earlier on, I think it's an absolute disgrace that it is possible still to qualify from any health and social care program without doing this work. That should just not be possible. But the fact that it is means that we end up then, you know, as Faye was saying before, with having to provide rapid response, emergency response to the health needs of our people. And the problem with that is, as so often happens, when the crisis is over, the money goes, if we get it at all. If organisations are being set up because the NHS, social care are not doing their job, but the funding is indeterminate. It's, you know, we're never sure from 1 minute to the next where it's going to come from. Then very often these are the institutions now, we're already hearing about charities talking about what proportion of them are likely to go to the wall after COVID. And unfortunately, a lot of those will be Black-led services. So we need to get what is our, we're not asking for anything that's not, we're not entitled to. What we're saying is we have a national health system, we have a social care system, and they are supposed to be delivered fairly and equitably and peace, so that anybody who needs them can receive the help and support they need. And part of that is training and equipping the people who are going to deliver that care to be able to do it in a culturally sensitive and appropriate way. And to give people, and also to give people the wherewithal to challenge that when it doesn't happen.
Yes. Challenge is definitely needed. Do we have any more questions from the audience?
If no one else has a question, I do. It's just a piece of information, really. Dawn, you were talking about a plan from 2016-17 that wasn't implemented. Can you tell us exactly what that plan was?
Okay, so it's an NHS. It's called the Mental Health 5-Year Forward View. So if you just type that into your search engine, you should find it. And it's just a really clear plan about saying these are all the problems with the system, highlights inequalities. But yeah,